Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a freshman Republican congressman answers questions from constituents about his vote in favor of a commission to investigate the U.S. Capitol attack. The Utah Jazz advance to the next round of the NBA playoffs. And a columnist offers her take on the importance of pride celebrations. Joining me for this conversation, we have got Salt Lake Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham. Good morning, Matt, and thanks for making time for this morning.
Good morning, Roger.
We've also got Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning and welcome, Robert.
Good morning, Roger.
And later in the show, we will hear from Jazz beat reporter Eric Walden and columnist Marina Gomberg, so stay tuned for that. Listeners, you can join with your questions and comments, the show, that is, tweet to at KCPW or call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We will start with a town hall that you covered, Matt Canham. This was a town hall held by Representative Blake Moore, who is maybe a less familiar name to a number of listeners. They are certainly more familiar with the name of his predecessor, Rob Bishop. Actually, what is his biography, Matt, and what's his background, if you can start with that?
Yeah, Blake Moore is a 40-year-old freshman Republican congressman who lives in Salt Lake City but represents northern Utah in the 1st District. He spent some time in the State Department doing some stuff he can't talk about. And he worked for the Cicero Group as a consultant when he came back here, and he navigated his way through a competitive race for the Republican nomination, and then has been a member of Congress all of 5 months so far.
Well, 5 months, and a freshman representative this week, he held a town hall in North Ogden, and at that event, he was peppered with a lot of questions, questions about things that he doesn't necessarily want to be talking about. What kinds of questions are we talking about, Matt?
Yeah, you know, Representative Moore believes for the Republican Party to move forward, it needs to focus on issues like security and the military and spending. And the voters at this town hall, they wanted to talk about Donald Trump. They wanted to talk about the 2020 election, and they wanted to talk about his vote in favor of a January 6th commission that would study the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Moore was one of 35 Republicans in the House who voted in favor of that bill, which passed the House of Representatives.
Okay, so this is the attack, January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. There were also, as I understand it, a number of people talking about voter fraud.
Right.
And these are interlinked topics, of course. Are the constituents who arrive, you said that they want to talk about Donald Trump. Are they those who believe that the 2020 presidential election, you know, was fraudulent, was stolen?
You know, it was an interesting town hall, and I haven't been to too many town halls recently, in part because of the pandemic.
Right.
You know, these were very cordial people. They seemed to like Representative Moore, but they seemed to disagree with Representative Moore on his approach to the election, on his approach to this attack on the Capitol. And while they didn't outright say the election was stolen, they hinted that there are problems that should have been addressed. They did not like that Representative Moore did not vote to try to disqualify the electoral ballots from the states of Arizona and Pennsylvania, like many other Republicans did. These were votes that took place on January 6th. If you recall, that's the day that Congress certifies the Electoral College vote for a presidential race. And that's why the pro-Trump mob was at the Capitol that day. But there was not, this was not an angry town hall, but it definitely they did press him on it.
Okay. Just because there is that active, you know, disinformation that's out there, and there has been for quite some time, and it seems necessary to point out that there's not credible evidence that has come to light that there was any kind of, you know, significant voter fraud during the 2020 election, right?
No, there has been no credible evidence. The election was secure. And, you know, what Representative Moore told these people was that when Congress certifies the electoral votes, what they are doing is essentially counting what the states bring them. And he said, there is no reason to object. There is no constitutional right to object unless the state says that a state has a problem. Hmm. Now, this has happened historically where a state has sent two slates of electors because of some problem in the state's voting. That did not happen in the 2020 election. No state indicated that their election was a problem, including Arizona and Pennsylvania. And so Representative Moore said that Republicans had no right to object to those electoral ballots.
Hmm. And this is then again, of course, this is what we're talking about here is that the objection. This is the vote that occurred on January 6th. That's the same day that this attack happened on the U.S. Capitol. The attack, again, as I said, is very much tied to the election fraud story. That big lie, as Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney called it. There's this congressional commission to investigate that attack. It's not going to happen. But right. Representative Moore wanted it. What did he tell constituents about why he wanted that commission to go forward, that bipartisan commission?
Yes. Representative Moore said that, you know, so to make this even more complicated, the president urges people to go to the Capitol because he thinks that they can somehow pressure Congress to invalidate the elections or invalidate the results of a legitimate election. That did not happen. Afterward, Congress impeached Donald Trump again for his role in inciting that insurrection. Representative Moore did not vote for that impeachment, but in his, which he called the hardest decision he's ever made, right. In his vote against impeachment afterward, he said that he supported a bipartisan commission. And so when this came up for a vote, he stuck to his guns and voted for it. You know, he thought that there were a number of issues this commission could have addressed, such as the fact that when there was an attack on the Capitol, no one in Congress had an idea of how to respond internally inside the building. That the Capitol Police were overwhelmed, that we had the National Guard was not called in despite lots of evidence, lots of intelligence that this attack was going to happen. And he thinks all of those are topics that the commission should have studied.
Hmm. And I want to get to his experience during the Capitol attack, because he described that during his town hall as well. Again, the commission isn't going to happen because it was blocked from being debated through, I guess the threat of filibuster, Matt. We can get into the weeds there. But just to point out the fact that Representatives Chris Stewart and Burgess Owens, they voted against the creation of this commission, whereas Representative Moore voted for it. And yeah. What about
John Curtis as well?
John Curtis voted for it as well. Okay. But so at this town hall, Blake Moore described his experience during the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6th, and he described what was a pretty scary situation. What did he say about those events?
Yes. So Representative Moore took the oath of office on January 3rd. January 6th was the third day on the job, his third day on the House floor. And he was on the House floor when the pro-Trump mob breached the Capitol and started running through the hallways. And he saw security start barricading the doors. His phone blows up with texts from his staff that are very disconcerting. He calls his wife, says that he doesn't know what's going on, and says, "I love you, hon." And then he's told he needs to get a gas mask. So they're trying to rip up these, you know, packages that contain gas masks, and he's handed them to a colleague. He gets one himself. There's this chaotic feeling of they don't know what's going on around them in the House floor, but people are barricading doors. Security has their guns drawn. A chaplain starts giving a prayer, and he said it was crazy. I mean, his quote was, "It is one of those moments where you're like, I don't have control right now." Hmm. The security, the police, which he called absolute heroes that day, got a group and started rushing them off the floor and into the tunnels of the Capitol. And if you've ever been to Washington, D.C. and at the Capitol, there are tunnels that go from the main Capitol building to a number of office buildings surrounding them. They're kind of a little bit of a labyrinth. And so they went down to the hallways, or in the tunnels, and they started rushing through. They got to an office building. They gathered in a cafeteria. Now, there are cafeteria workers there. There are people, you know, eating. And there's a group of police with a group of lawmakers. All of the lawmakers wear pins that identify them as a member of the House of Representatives. And Representative Moore felt very unsafe in this open scenario of a cafeteria, because, as he said, he was the target. Lawmakers were the reason the mob was there. And so he decided it was not the place to be. So he left that group, made his own way to his office, and he bunkered down with his staff for hours.
How, Matt, I'm just wondering, I want to bring in the news columnist on this in just a moment, but Matt, how, it's a wide perspective to ask for, but how did the constituents who were in attendance at this town hall in North Ogden, how did they respond, or did they, to the experience that Representative Moore described there, and to his explanations for voting for that commission and voting to certify the 2020 presidential election?
I would guess that, you know, there are some outspoken people who thought he should not have voted to certify the election, that there was some discrepancies, which we've already talked about, there's no evidence of. They also did not like that he voted for the commission, because they believe, and Republicans have stated, a number of Republicans have stated, that they think the Democrats will use this to bludgeon Republicans in the 2022 midterm. They did find his story about being at the Capitol compelling. You know, the one thing about his story that, you know, we haven't heard before is it allows you to be in the eyes of a lawmaker, and particularly a new lawmaker, during a very violent incident. Many police officers were injured. Multiple people died. There has been some effort to downplay what happened on that day. But if you watch the videos, it's scary. And Representative Moore was vulnerable at this meeting and talked about how he was afraid. And I think that that was compelling to the people who were there.
Let's bring in the news columnist and Robert, the enemy was inside that building, the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. But Representative Moore here is holding town halls and, you know, this is basically what he has to talk about, being in favor of a bipartisan commission, voting to certify the election, you know, trying to uphold the American electoral system instead of other things. I mean, this is where the country is. I don't know what to ask you about that. I mean, I guess we can't move on. Can we move on? When can we move on? Ever?
Well, I mean, I think, as Matt touched on at the beginning, that his constituents that were at that meeting, this is what they're still interested in. So
yeah.
I think pretty clearly, no, they've not moved on, or they're not willing to move on. And I think maybe it's a little early to move on. We still don't have real accountability for it. We've got dozens, scores, if not hundreds of criminal cases making their way through the system. I think there are 5 Utahns who've been charged with participating in it. It might be 6 now. So I think, to Blake Moore's credit, I mean, he is from the most conservative or the most Republican leaning district in the state. And he was willing to stand up there and be held accountable by his constituents for the votes that he took. And I think it was the right vote. I think we need to get answers about what happened. And this sort of 9/11 commission styled investigation, I think, would be worthwhile. But yeah, it's not going to sit well with his more strident members, strident constituents. And I think, you know, to his credit, he stood there and answered the questions. If I could bootstrap it into a column I wrote earlier
Please
this
do.
Week.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this, because this is a column, I'm assuming, the one about who is more likely to believe, you know, these conspiracies, the widely discredited theory that the election was stolen, and polls showed that that members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were especially buying into to that conspiracy. And go ahead, jump off from there.
Yeah, there was a PRRI. They mostly do religious affiliated polling. They do a big poll on a regular basis. And it found that about 46% of LDS members believed the idea that the election was stolen. which was the second highest next to the evangelical community, you know, in terms of believing that. Y2 Analytics did polling specific to Utah, and the numbers came back about the same when it came to LDS members. But that's not really what's driving this belief in conspiracy theories. The much stronger predictor is the Republicans believe it. 71% of Republicans believe that there was enough election fraud to turn the outcome of the election. And 78% of Trump supporters, so that includes some independent independents who voted for Trump, believe that the election was stolen. So, you know, going to your initial question, no, I think people are not prepared to move on, and it's pretty clear that they haven't moved on. And I think what it takes is for people like Blake Moore and people like Mitt Romney to speak the truth and tell their constituents, no, this is what happened. I was there. We need some answers, and we need to get to the bottom of what happened. And I think that, you know, it's unfortunate that this investigation, this commission got bogged down and tied up in politics in the Senate, we probably aren't going to have that. I think history will ultimately tell what happened, but I think it would be beneficial to have that objective, nonpartisan investigation conducted. And then, look, it's not going to really change anybody's minds, I don't think, because we know based on recent years in politics, people are so entrenched in their own viewpoint that just because here's a factual report, people are not necessarily going to believe it if it conflicts with their preconceived worldview. But there's value in going through the exercise, I think. And producing the best product he can. And to Blake Moore's credit, he supported doing that.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Mike Lee, for one, did not.
Yeah, I want to just on the question of the commission, not to belabor the point, but I've heard people say, you know, hey, there are criminal cases, there are people being charged, it's going through the courts, as you brought up. And so, you know, is that not accountability enough? I guess there's a sort of broader question, again, about what Liz Cheney called the big lie, et cetera, and its role in impelling all of that. Is that what's missing from these criminal cases? Or I don't know. Yeah. How do you want to respond to that argument?
I think to some degree, yes. I mean, I think there's individual accountability for the people who participated directly in it. That is, again, working its way through the courts. And that's how you get to individual accountability. But there's not systemic accountability, you know, there's not the larger accountability for the failures of the Capitol Police to prepare for it, and the National Guard to be deployed, for the failures of the Pentagon to authorize National Guard troops to be deployed to try to quell the riot. What happened in the White House? Were they not given permission? I mean, there's these lingering questions that exist out there that I think are important from a systemic standpoint that we need to address. And also, you know, to what extent was this pre-planned and prepared and a premeditated attack on democracy? I mean, those are pretty fundamental, large questions that I don't know that we get to through the courts necessarily. And so I think there's got to be a more, you know, broad brush look at what went on.
Hey, Matt Canham, just going back to the town hall, we'll head to a break here in a moment, but the town hall, the questions, politically, it might be easier to just go along with what amounts to a popular falsehood that, you know, about the election. Representative Moore is choosing not to do that. And I'm wondering if that makes him, a target, if he's going to face a challenger who's willing to go ahead and get on board with the quote unquote big lie.
You know, that's possible. And I think that he knows it's possible, which is part of why he talked about, you know, near the end of this 2-hour town hall, he came back to the topic of the commission. And he said the easiest thing for him to do was to say, I support a bipartisan commission, just not this one. And try to just duck this vote and not be on the record. And he said that could have avoided a lot of issues. But what he said is that he's going to show up. He's going to continue to talk to Republican delegates. He's going to state his case. And he hopes that they understand his motivations and give him a continued opportunity to serve. So I know that he's concerned about it. Whether that's an actual reality, I mean, I don't know. if someone wants to try to run against Representative Moore from the right or not. We'll see. That election will be in 2022.
But right.
It was something that he thought of.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. That's Matt Canham, who is senior federal government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. When we come back, we'll talk about how the Utah Jazz organization responded to some racist comments from fans here in Salt Lake City. And we'll hear from Utah Jazz beat writer Eric Walden on the Jazz playoffs run. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Herald Journal, your in-depth source of local Cache Valley news, delivering local, state, and national news directly to your home, offering online and U.S. mail newspaper delivery, information at hjnews.com or 752-2121.
I'm Jerrica D. Wortham, a poet and author from Tulsa, Oklahoma. 100 years ago, a race massacre took place in our historic Greenwood District, nicknamed Black Wall Street because of its wealth and entrepreneurial spirit. I want to show you how our community is marking both the centennial and the remarkable success of Black Wall Street through art and music. That's Hip Hop and Healing, commemorating Tulsa on the BBC World Service.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio. It's about a half an hour away now. Hope you'll join us for that. And glad you're with us for Behind the Headlines.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. In just a few minutes, we're going to turn to a conversation with Jazz beat writer Eric Walden on the Jazz playoffs run. But while I've still got Robert Gerke, news columnist, I wanted to ask about his column on how the Jazz as an organization and to some extent how Utah as a state responded after some racist and demeaning comments from fans here in Utah directed at the parents of a star player on the opposing team, the Memphis Grizzlies. Well, that's one part of your column, Robert. Maybe just on the beginning part of that, remind us what happened, the most recent bad, you know, ugly behavior from some people attending a game that elicited a response from the team and from others.
Yeah. So in game two of the playoffs, Ja Morant had he's a star from the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yeah.
Was having a terrific game. His dad, T. Morant, and mother Jamie were in the stands. And there was some sort of playful banter apparently between T and some of the fans around him. And some fans took it way, way too far and said some things that were, and I don't even want to repeat them on the radio. You can read the story if you want to find out what was said.
Yeah.
But it was pretty disgusting stuff. The fans, surrounding fans, went and got security, had these people escorted out. They were banned indefinitely from the arena, from Jazz games in the future. And so, you know, it was, the context of it is, though, that, you know, Utah has had some high profile incidents like this in the past.
Right. Where
the same day that this occurred, a judge had dismissed a case filed by a fan who had made derogatory and racist comments toward Russell Westbrook, who was a villain, I guess, you know, in the Jazz rivalries through the years. But, you know, the team banned him. He said he was defamed by Russell Westbrook and by the franchise. And so he had sued them. The case was dismissed. But again, these incidents crop up. And I wanted to make clear in the column, I don't necessarily think that Jazz fans are, on the whole, you know,
right,
racist. I mean, I think the fans that alerted security, that saw that this was not okay and stood up to it, should be applauded. There was also Twitter videos of some brothers who bought T. Morant a beer. T. reciprocated, bought the next round. You know, so there can be these heated rivalries. There can be competition, but you know, when it goes too far, it goes too far. And I think the Jazz franchise, as a franchise, responded to it appropriately. As to their credit, they have in the past when these incidents have arisen. But it also kind of drove home for me how the Jazz have, as a team, you know, both the players and the front office, have sort of become the social conscience for our state on these issues of race and justice.
Right.
And that goes, you know, from this long history of Donovan Mitchell being outspoken about civil rights and social justice and police reform, and, you know, Breonna Taylor and on and on. It's this new era of superstars who aren't, you know, going to be boxed into this play basketball and shut your mouth kind of mentality. They are humans, and they have, you know, more, they have beliefs beyond the basketball court, and they're willing to share those. And I think it's terrific. Yep. It hasn't always been easy for the Jazz, frankly. I mean, you know, there was this blow up where a fan asked Spencer Cox about the scholarship program that this fan in particular thought was racist, and what Spencer Cox was going to do about this scholarship program the Jazz were doing that, you know, sent scholarships to minority Utah high school students. And the governor's response was right. You know, the Jazz can send money to who they want to send money to. They're a private organization. And, you know, they're doing something positive for the community and trying to lift people up. You know, that blew up in conservative world. It made Tucker Carlson, who, you know, called Spencer Cox stupid, called the program immoral. You know, but, you know, the Jazz stuck to their guns. And there was a great viral video, if you haven't seen it, I highly encourage you to go look at it, where these Jazz fans are notifying the first 30 recipients of these scholarships that they'd received them. And you can just see the joy in these young people's eyes, and frankly, in the players' eyes. I mean, this is probably one of the better parts of their job when they get to do something like this. So I they deserve a lot of credit for what they're doing, because in this community, they're probably the most high profile, prominent spokespeople on these issues. They speak to people who, you know, are like me, you know, middle-aged white men who probably don't get that perspective in a lot of other parts of their lives. And so to their credit, I think they're doing a service to the state.
And as you point out in your column, Donovan Mitchell says that they're not going to, he told Andy Larson, the Salt Lake Tribune's Jazz beat reporter, one of the Jazz beat reporters there, that he doesn't have any intention of letting up on being a voice for those issues. And just to close, or sort of close the circle here, the Utah Jazz, they apologized, I think, to Ja Morant's family and gave them front row tickets, or, you know, close to courtside tickets.
Brian Smith brought tea back for game five, I guess it was. Brought him back for game five and sat with him courtside, and I think that was a classy, you know, symbolic move as well. Okay. And you know, so, you know, good on them, and good on the Jazz, and they're doing well on the court, and they're doing good off the court as well.
You know, just before we turn to the Jazz playoff run, and then a conversation about Pride Month and Pride celebrations with Marina Gomberg, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, we're going to let our two guests go. But actually, Matt and Robert, let's try and squeeze in some underplayed stories, a segment that normally comes at the end of this show, where we, you know, might feature a story that could have passed you by, or that you just want to draw attention to. And Matt Canham, if you're ready, do you want to get the ball rolling with an underplayed story pick?
Sure. I'll pick one that we actually posted this morning from our colleague, Aaron Alberti. The University of Utah has launched a clinic focused on helping long haulers who have COVID-19. These are the people who got the coronavirus and have had just unending problems weeks and months later. Some of them were ignored early on or dismissed. There is now a centralized place at the University of Utah for them to get a lot of help.
That's an interesting pick, and yeah, the lingering effects for some people of COVID-19, it drives home to me the fact that there's still a lot we don't know about this virus.
There's a ton, and a lot of it is neurological problems, which are very concerning.
Okay. Matt Canham's pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Thank you, Matt Canham. Robert Gerke, how about yourself? What have you got for an underplayed story?
I like Matt's pick a lot. I'm going to go with a piece that Zach Podmore did. It looks at the state's response to this oil and gas drilling moratorium that the Biden administration has floated or imposed, I guess, and the impact on Utah. And what Zach was able to uncover was, and with the help, I guess, of an advocacy group, was that the state had done internal reports that said that it wasn't going to have much of an impact unless it extended over like 8 years. But that didn't change the fact that the messaging from the state was that this is going to deprive Utah of oil and gas, of energy, of jobs. The report said that there's plenty of oil and gas available, and most of the drilling is taking place on state land anyway that wouldn't be impacted. But the industry groups pushed the state to take a more aggressive, assertive stance, and contrary to their internal analysis of the situation. So check that out. I think it's good. Good accountability journalism by Zach and worth a read.
Yeah, absolutely worth a read, and an interesting sort of look at politics at the same time and the influence of industry. All right, that's a great pick. Thank you, Robert Gerke, for your pick there. I'm going to go with the Biden administration saying that it plans to distribute at least 80 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the rest of the world by the end of this month. And lots of parts of the globe are in their worst days of this pandemic. And so just the sooner that we can get vaccines to the entire world, the better. That's one pick. And then I guess just because we have a little more time, another is the governor, Utah Governor Spencer Cox. This is probably not underplayed, asking everyone to pray for rain this weekend together. He issued a call that was ecumenical, you know, asked for everybody of all faiths to pray to God or whatever higher power you believe in for rain, because Utah is experiencing a severe drought and a coming heat wave, which we're going to experience today with temperatures near 100 degrees here in Salt Lake City. With that, I will say Matt Canham, senior federal government reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, Robert Gerke, news columnist with that same paper. Thanks to both of you for being here on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You as well. A reminder that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. A bit later in the show, June is Pride Month, and so we'll turn to a columnist's take on the ongoing need for Pride celebrations. But right now, we're going to dip into a segment with Utah Jazz beat writer Eric Walden. The Jazz have advanced to the next round of the playoffs, and we checked in with Eric to hear about the road ahead. But I started the conversation off by asking Eric what stood out to him about the Jazz's 4-1 series victory against the Memphis Grizzlies. Take a listen.
As you recall, when we were kind of previewing that first round series, and we didn't know at the time whether it was going to be the Grizzlies or the Golden State Warriors, and you asked, you know, what's the preference? And I said, well, if we want great basketball, root for the Warriors. If you want an easier path for the Jazz, root for the Grizzlies. Well, we got the Grizzlies, and it turned out to be both great basketball and, you know, a relatively easy path. The Jazz win the series 4-1, which looks like a blowout, but we saw a bunch of those games where Memphis was a very resilient team, especially for being as young as they are. They're one of the youngest teams in the NBA, but man, they kind of played above their heads for a lot of the series. So what stood out to me was that the Jazz answered that resilience. You know, the Jazz had lulls during some of these games. The attention wanes, you know, the offense slows down, the defense isn't always as precise as it needed to be. And we saw the Grizzlies able to take advantage of that in moments, saw them, you know, make big comebacks, saw them make rallies in games. But then we saw the Jazz not panic. We saw them have the capacity to absorb that comeback and then to answer it with one of their own. So, you know, in years past, the Jazz didn't have maybe enough firepower in some years. They didn't have enough defensive fortitude in some years, that those runs by the Grizzlies would have been fatal to the Jazz in previous seasons. And this year, they're well balanced enough on both sides of the ball that they're like, okay, yeah, we let up for a minute. That's out of our system. And now we're getting back to business. And we saw the Jazz take it to them in those instances. And that's why they wind up winning the last 4 games of the series and closing it out in pretty
tidy fashion. Yeah. The impact of Donovan Mitchell obviously is pretty recognizable. I mean, the only game that the Jazz lost was when he was still out. I don't know if you can only attribute it to that. And of course, the story is by no means just about Donovan. Huge contributions from so many others, but he showed himself to be a star, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. You know, when this team, when it has Donovan Mitchell, is so much closer to playing at its peak than when it's without him. And, you know, they've built this team to be able to withstand absences like that. You know, that's why missing Donovan Mitchell for the last 16 games of the regular season with that sprained ankle, they didn't fall apart. You know, they were able to keep their hold on the number one seed because they had Rudy Gobert step up and Bojan Bogdanovic step up and Jordan Clarkson step up. But there's no getting around it, you know, and we saw this in the first half of game five when Donovan Mitchell is on. There are not that many guys in the NBA capable of playing at the level that he played at, where he scored 26 points on 10 of 13 shooting in, you know, before halftime. So just absolutely crazy to watch. And yeah, if Donovan is healthy for the remainder of this run, like, that's half the battle right there.
I mentioned those huge contributions, and those included, as you said, Rudy and Clarkson and Ingles and everyone. But, you know, somebody who also had an amazing series was Mike Conley, and who is now maybe injured. Do we know how bad his injury is and what happened there, Eric? I mean, will he be back by the start of the next series, I guess, is the question at the forefront of our minds.
Well, we're recording this at a most inopportune time, but as it stands right now, Mike had an MRI on Thursday morning, and we are right now waiting to hear the results of that.
Also, we're recording on Thursday afternoon, and so the news could be coming out before the show goes to air.
In fact, we expect it to come out sometime on Thursday afternoon, and I just haven't, you know, I don't have it quite yet, unfortunately, but. Mike was good enough to speak to us post game five, which is an encouraging sign in itself because NBA players, when they are hurt, are not obligated to do media availability. So his willingness to do that is encouraging. Beyond that, he mentioned that. So he said he first felt a tug in his right hamstring near the end of the first quarter. He made the team trainers aware of it, said, "Hey, just so you know, I felt this." This has been a recurring problem for Mike throughout the season. He missed 21 regular season games in several stretches over the year because he never had a full hamstring pull, from what I'm told, but he tweaked it a few times, and it's been kind of a recurring problem. So he said he felt another tweak in the first quarter of game five, made the trainers aware of it, wanted to try to play through it, see if it would, you know, go away on its own, said it was getting increasingly sore, decided to check out, go back to the locker room for some treatment. And at that point, you know, the Jazz finished the first quarter up 47-27 and were looking in very good shape. And they made the decision to just pull the plug on his playing for the rest of that night because, frankly, he wasn't needed. But
They had the luxury of making that decision,
yeah,
I guess. Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, you're not wrong when you say that he was excellent against the Grizzlies. He was arguably the Jazz's most valuable player of that series. So we're waiting word on how severe it is. Mike said that he felt like it was not as bad as the tweak that he suffered near the end of the regular season. What does that mean? Again, we don't know. That injury kept him out for 9 games. He did say it's his hope that he'll be available by game one of the second round series, which, depending on how other games go, will come either Sunday or Tuesday. So yeah, it's kind of one of those wait and see type things, you know.
I'll try and bring listeners up to speed as I come out of this interview as to where Mike Conley stands. But you know, as you just mentioned, the Jazz are waiting now on the winners of the Mavericks Clippers series. I asked you that question about who we'd rather face when it came to Memphis versus Golden State.
Who do we want to face in the second round now? That's a good question. So as it stands right now, the Mavericks are leading that series 3-2. You have to win 4 to advance. They are playing game 6 on Friday night in Dallas. So you would think theoretically the Mavs are in great position, right? They've got home court advantage. The road team has won every game in that series thus far. So it's kind of crazy. There are things to like and dislike about both teams in terms of a Jazz matchup. The Mavericks, Kind of the conventional wisdom in playoff series among NBA fans is the team with the best player on the floor is generally the favorite to win, right? Well, this year you'd probably argue that's Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks. He's been absolutely incredible all year long. He's averaged near a 30-point triple-double over the course of the season, which is amazing. It's kind of unprecedented. He's been dealing with some nerve issues in his neck and back that have, you know, hampered him over a couple of games. But when he's looked right, he's been great. So, you know, do you want to go up against that guy? I don't know. The difference is the rest of the Mavericks supporting cast is probably considered lesser than the Clippers. The Clippers have a couple of stars in their own right, and Kawhi Leonard, who's a two-time NBA Finals MVP. So he has a history of clutch performances in the playoffs. The Clippers also have a guy named Paul George, who's a multi-time All-Star, but who honestly has a little bit of a history of not playing well in the playoffs, which runs counter to his self-given nickname of Playoff P. But there's things to like and dislike about both. Honestly, I think probably I believe the Mavericks are a worse team and maybe a better matchup for the Jazz. So again, if you want the easier path, if you want the path of least resistance, maybe root for Dallas to lose game six at home, but then win game seven on Sunday in Los Angeles, just so that Mike Conley has a couple of extra days of rest before the Mavericks wind up advancing.
Just before we wrap up here, and I'm taking more time than I think I said I would take from you, but the Utah Jazz franchise lost a legend since we last talked and since the last time we aired this show. Mark Eaton, a big figure on and off the court. How has the organization been responding? How has the community been responding? I know you covered this. An unexpected death.
Yeah, I was in Memphis when the news broke, and honestly, you know, it's something that you don't expect to hear, just because, you know, Mark was, what, 63 years old, and you know, for him to die in a bicycle accident is just not something that you ever anticipate. But Mark was a beloved figure in the Jazz organization, and you know, we spoke to people who are currently in the organization about the impact that he had. You know, Quinn Snyder spoke about how, you know, Mark was kind of a reluctant figure to come into the locker room and speak to players because he didn't want to, you know, be the old guy hanging around. You know, he didn't want, you know, he's like, my time is over, it's about these guys now. But he was definitely a mentor to Rudy Gobert. You know, Mark was a two-time defensive player of the year, and as a 7'4" big man playing for the Utah Jazz, you know, he was able to kind of teach Rudy about, you know, carrying on the mantle of being a big defensive oriented guy for the Utah Jazz. You know, he had a unique perspective on that. So Rudy absolutely loved him, and you know, they got along pretty famously. I also got the chance to speak to, you know, contemporaries of Mark, guys who he had played with over the years. You know, Mark had an 11-year NBA career, and pretty incredible for a guy who, you know, didn't originally have designs on playing basketball. You know, he famously worked as an auto mechanic when a junior college basketball coach came in to get his car fixed and saw this 7'4" behemoth and said, "Why aren't you playing basketball?" Mark was making $20,000 at the time and said, "That's too good of money to give up to go like chase this dream." So everyone loved Mark. The theme that came up kind of consistently is not what he did on the court, which, two-time defensive player of the year and an all-star, like, those accomplishments speak for themselves, but they all spoke to what a kind person he was, how he went out of his way to make guys, you know, feel at home, feel comfortable. Blue Edwards spoke about how he was Mark's quote-unquote rookie. You know, Mark was the one responsible for kind of bringing him into the NBA and getting him acclimated to this, frankly, when you think about it, this absolutely bizarre, insane world of professional basketball. And anyone who we talked to about Mark Eaton just repeatedly brought up what a kind person he was, what a giving person he was. After his playing days were over, he worked for the Retired Players Association, looking to get benefits for players who, you know, didn't have a lot of success post-career, who didn't make a ton of money, who maybe were down on their luck, and trying to, you know, do things to help them out and get them in better circumstances. So that's the kind of guy Mark Eaton was.
Yeah, I read about the, especially for the players who came up at a time when professional basketball wasn't paying the kinds of salaries that it ended up paying, and you know, people who spent years giving their time to it, but came out of it with basically nothing. And his dedication to trying to help them, as you just said, find some means of making it work. Eric Walden, we could go on, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but really appreciate your coverage, and I will be looking to you to come back and hopefully keep doing this for a number of weeks going forward.
Hey, I understand you've got more relevant news to do, but I'm always happy to talk basketball with you for a little bit.
Again, that's Salt Lake Tribune Jazz beat writer Eric Walden. And I'll just mention that Mike Conley's status is still basically questionable. An MRI revealed that he has a hamstring strain, and so whether or not he'll play at the start of the next series remains to be seen. We're going to take a quick break in the show. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll take a look at Pride celebrations in the state of Utah. Stay with us.
This is Science by the Slice. The periaqueductal gray is a partially uncharted region of the brain. USU biologist Aaron Bobeck and her students are investigating a newly identified G-protein-coupled receptor in this area of the brain called GPR171. The receptor's role, they say, appears to be enhancing the pain-reducing effects of the brain's opioid receptors. Their findings could help efforts to develop safer alternatives to highly addictive opioid drug therapies.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Science, offering degree programs in the sciences and mathematics. Details at usu.edu/science.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This show is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting and writing from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. To wrap up today, we will speak with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Marina Gomberg. Marina wrote a column this week that earnestly answered a tongue-in-cheek question about the need for Pride celebrations. Take a listen. Marina Gomberg, Salt Lake Tribune columnist. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Roger. It's nice to be here.
So June is Pride Month, and you wrote this week about Pride celebrations. And actually, the jumping off point for your column was a likely rhetorical question, but a question that you seem bandied about, which is, why is Pride even happening, you know, now that gays can get married?
Right.
The question is a joke, but you decided to take it very seriously and to answer it earnestly. And I could read from your column, obviously, but the point is that there is a need for these celebrations, and it's an enormous need. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Yeah, I think that there is a need. And what's interesting to me about the question of why do we still have to have Pride celebrations when gays can get married is that it really illuminates just how there's still a gap in understanding about the plight of being LGBTQIA+ in Utah and in the world. And that, you know, to think that maybe we were only focused on a singular issue of marriage is sort of to really erase a lot of history and a lot of the issues around trans rights and trans safety and access to public accommodations and hate crimes bills and all of these things that have been issues that have kept us from legal equity. And so it really illuminated that. And then to actually look at these issues and to say, no, we don't live with legal equality at this moment in time. And our legislative session is a great example of how we continue to fight anti-LGBTQ, specifically anti-trans legislation all the time. And we're gearing up for it again in 2022.
Marina, I mean, the work for equality, for equity is ongoing, but there have been, you know, these significant successes in the struggle for rights. Many of them are just extremely recent. And then, of course, yeah, you're pointing out the anti-transgender legislation, the risks that are out there for transgender people. You talked about some pretty scary statistics when it comes to people getting murdered. I guess the need is obvious, but how do you encapsulate that? I don't know what the question is here.
Well, I think what I would say is to somebody who's questioning why we still need it, the response from me is a little bit about why, but mostly join us and find out, because A, it is fun. I mean, it is colorful and it is loud and engaging and happy. And it's one of my favorite things about the Pride movement is that as somebody who studied the history of social justice movements, Pride is one that is so rooted in rainbows and happiness and love. So it's just fun. And I think that there's benefit in being able to see that, like, people are still trying to define how we think about gender and sexuality. And that is I don't know that it'll ever be done, that work, and that they're welcome too, that this isn't just a thing that celebrates those crazy queers. Everybody is welcome to be a part of this if you are willing to, as I say, sort of sit down at this communal table and feast on the bounty that is the diversity that the Pride Festival brings together. So I think that there's a need for people to have it for LGBTQ people. And there's as much need to have Pride for everybody else, allies and folks who don't yet know their allies. And that's all the categories that exist. You're either LGBTQ, an ally, or a soon-to-be ally, in my mind.
You write, grab a rainbow boa, suspend your judgment of yourself, come on, and mm-hmm. of others, and join us. You deserve to love more, too. I think it's a really great sentiment. Just one more thing that I want to read from your column, if I may. You say, Pride, at least as well as I can articulate it, is the manifestation of queer joy and a celebration of our perseverance in the struggle to belong. And I mean, yeah, that kind of speaks for itself. The struggle to belong. I'm struck by the fact that even the successes are not ancient history. They're very, very recent history, and there's still a struggle ahead of you.
You're exactly right. I mean, we look at, like, in 1964, we passed the Civil Rights Act, and do Black Americans live as freely as white Americans? Absolutely not. Legal equality is the goal in legal arenas. Social equity and justice and acceptance and belonging is the real goal. And we just are not there, you know, but Pride celebrations move us closer. And yes, there are sometimes platforms for the legal work, the policy changes, even to allow businesses to sort of be like, hey, we're queer friendly too. We're LGBT friendly. And to allow a mom of a person who just came out to be find other moms or to just see what a community looks like that is different from one that maybe they've known before. And so it is something that, you know, I think all of us in all walks of life want to feel like we belong. There's just been an immense amount of pressure to exclude LGBTQ people from safety, from housing, from jobs, from marriage, from all of these different things. And while we've chipped away at that inequity, we have a journey yet to go. And that's what Pride's about. And my guess is even when we have legal equality and maybe even social equality, we still just might want to get some short shorts on and have a couple rainbow jello shots about it, you know, because it's fun.
That's Marina Gomberg, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, wrapping up this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio. Support for Project Resilience programming on UPR is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.
A BBC special, Hip Hop and Healing, is top of the hour. We hope you'll stay tuned. You're listening to Utah Public Radio. It's now 10 o'clock.